Welcome back, everybody. We'd always like to have you guys check us out on where, Don?
TheValleyOutdoors.com.
He remembers it.
Go ahead, Ava.
Facebook.
Facebook, like us, please. Absolutely. And again, if you're somewhere out and about, you want to check it out. If you're bored in your stand, just pull it up, TheValleyOutdoors.com. Check out the interactive map. And maybe if the deer aren't going where you are, then you're going to find someplace where maybe next year or something, you find out where the deer are going. So a lot of cool stuff on there. Mm-hmm. Very interactive and kind of cool. So a lot of fun. I like it a lot, as they say. You ever heard that before, Don?
I have, yes. Okay. Yes, I have.
You know, deer hunting, if you look at the temperatures that are happening this across the Midwest, it's relatively mild. You know, we're looking
at, yes,
you know, the 50s.
Yeah, I mean, 40s. One day, I think, in our area, it's going to get down into the 30s. But
nothing on the overnight low. And then during the day, it's like 43, 44.
Yeah.
If you haven't already, one of the cool parts about deer hunting at this time of year, if it's decent temperature and you're by a body of water, go fishing. Go out and do the morning hunt, go fish in the afternoon, and then come back in and go for the evening hunt. You can have a blast. I mean, it's just, that's so fun to be able to do everything in one weekend. And it reduces sometimes if it's boredom or if you get your deer in the morning, guess what?
You can get a lot of fishing in then.
Yeah. Yeah. So don't be afraid of that this time of year. Fish are putting the feed bag on. Get out there. If you haven't done that before this time of year, what a rush. That I love fall fishing. It's just, there's just nothing like it. Absolutely nothing like it. So don't be afraid. Mix it up. Kind of fun. Right before the break, I happened to mention something about treetops, and I saw this come across the wire, and I thought it was rather funny, but then I thought, once again, wait a minute. I always wonder where they got the treetops when you go to these floral places and different artistic pieces, and you know what I mean?
Sure.
So, the story goes, Minnesota DNR brings felony charges in an illegal spruce top case. Out of Babbitt, Minnesota, the DNR is pressing felony charges against a Babbitt, Minnesota man for the recent illegal harvest of more than 5,000 spruce top trees on private and county property, according to St. Louis County criminal complaint.
What's he going to do with 5,000 treetops?
Babbitt Conservation Officer Anthony Rommel said this isn't the first time he's caught this individual harvesting batches of spruce tops. You guys, this is why it stood out. I just laughed. This isn't the first time. When he seized about 1,300 tops in late October, he also caught him last October when he was in possession of more than 1,500 spruce tops.
Slow learner.
This particular individual has been a real habitual, perennial violator, and I thought it only referred to flowers. That I've caught numerous times this season and every year. It's hard because, honestly, I think the biggest loss for them or punishment for them is losing their tops, not legal action. In previous times, the alleged offender was apprehended illegally harvesting spruce. The DNR pressed misdemeanor charges. However, the case, the punishment from last year is still to be determined and hasn't been brought to court yet. Still hasn't had any consequences from last year's violation. The official felony charges for timber theft, failure to obtain consent to cut decorative materials, and litter on public and private property, or commonly known as decorative forest theft. Now, the other thing that comes up, too, is birch. There's a lot of birch that are used in decorative floral arrangements for Christmas. So cases of decorative theft like spruce top cutting are typically charged as misdemeanors or gross misdemeanors, incurring fines, requiring restitution, or whatever. This individual, however, sought to bring his first felony charge to the activity due to the alleged offender's recurring illegal spruce top cutting each year. I'm just hoping the felony charge maybe gets to court and maybe this takes a little bit more seriously by the individual. From September 1st to October 28th, he's harvested around 3,900 spruce tops from county property and 1,300 from an adjacent private land.
Again, what is, I mean, is he using them for decorations?
Yeah. You sell them to...
He sell them to people that decorate.
Yeah.
It is amazing what one individual can do. Is insane. Yeah. In a two-month time span, not even 2 months, he did that?
Yeah.
One person. One individual did all that.
Many landowners feel a sense of violation discovering someone was illegally chopping spruce tops on their property. This particular landowner was pretty upset because he's a fourth-generation logger and he cares about the trees. He understands the value of the trees. Since becoming a conservation officer in the Babbitt area, they've seen an uptick in cases during the past 7 years. Annually, he investigates cases from the end of September to Thanksgiving holiday as illegal harvesters profit from selling holiday decor like mini Christmas trees that spruce tops look like. The market's there. They're definitely decorative arrangements and things that they use the spruce tops for. And there's a lot of resources up here. It's become a very large time use during the fall for a lot of us. With the lucrative market, there's individuals who harvest decorative spruce materials each year with permits from the state, which then it's legal. With that in mind, enforcement's usually enough deterrent most of the time. A few years ago, had one perennial spruce top thief. They did kind of get put out of business because of the fines and restitutions that they have to pay. So it's not a waste of time to enforce. Recommends landowners in northern Minnesota keep watchful eye on their spruce bogs and spruce groves in the property and report activity as they may see. Illegal spruce harvesters may work in the night or daytime. Landowners should look for specific traffic patterns in and out of forestry property and let conservationists know if there's any suspicious activity. So, what do you think of that?
Well, I mean, it's they maybe need to go where the market is and find out who's buying them if they're aware that they're buying illegal product. I'm guessing they might be.
I think so, it's a very possible.
Well, they'd be compliant to be.
You know, in that situation, it can be kind of tough because, you know, there is a legal harvest that can be there, but it's not the purchaser's job to figure out who's legal and who's not. So that's kind of where, how do you end up figuring that out? But
anyway.
Very topical piece coming up now, looking at venison care, Don.
Yes.
And when you're looking at any time of year where it's relatively warm and above freezing, and obviously keeping meat fresh and preventing it from going bad is a solid topic. Off and on, we've talked about various ways to deal with the meat once you get it. A couple key points that I think the article really brings up. One is picking your shot, making sure you know where you're going to hit the deer so it's not necessarily going to run, but they talk about double lung hit or heart shot. There are a few locations you could hit a deer that are more of a guarantee of a deer dying than a gut shot. If you deer hunt long enough, you'll miss a deer, and you will wound a deer that you don't recover, unfortunately, as that is. In the past few years, the renaissance of blood-trailing dogs has made the gut shot much less scary than it was in the past. If you have a pass shot or a gut shot, your odds of recovery are nearly 100% if you give the deer enough time and employ a tracking dog. And that's happening a lot. And we talked about it earlier, Don, the capability that you have with the drone technology now. Unfortunately, you're not to employ drones. That's an illegal thing, but it is a technology that I think may be something to look at because you can, if it's approved, you can have the infrared and you will lose less animals and you'll be able to figure out where that animal is. So you'll have to be able to pick it up with infrared. So it's something I think.
But those drones with infrared are not inexpensive. No, I mean, they're like $15,000.
Yeah.
So it's not one. So it's not every hunter is going to be out in the field with one of those.
It's not going to be a matter of you're going to be herding deer or tracking.
And you're not going to track them with a regular camera.
No.
on a drone as well, because I can barely see them out my back window when they're laying down. I had four of them laying in the backyard the other day, and I mean, I got my binoculars, and they're laying there. They're looking right at you.
Yeah, and you're like,
you can't see them.
No.
I mean, it's amazing how they blend in.
It is, and I think that's one of the things that needs to be looked at. But again, keeping looking at it, when you shoot a deer, the idea is don't chase it right away.
Right. Give it
time.
You
just don't. Minimum wait time is 6 hours. Give them 6 hours for it to expire, with a 12-hour wait time being safe bet if you're dealing with a gut shot. And the temperature's forecast to stay above 40 degrees overnight. It's a real gamble letting a deer lie that long. So that's a key piece to it.
If the temperature is above 40.
Above 40.
Yeah.
It's hard to trust how that venison will last in that scenario. For that simple reason, there's standard practice to be extremely picky about the shots, especially during heat wave. Very key piece to it. Quality of venison is not something you want to mess around with. If you don't think you can get it, can quickly and ethically dispatch a deer, don't take the shot. And it's not worth it because the meat will be deteriorated, which is unfortunate. Utilizing game bags. Have you used a game bag before?
I have not.
The technology that comes in a game bag is just incredible. Game bags you have available today, substantially better than what our forefathers had to deal with. If you're hunting out of state or going into deep public land, here at home there's no way that you'll find me without game bags in my pack. Game bags that incorporate antimicrobial technology that can make a real difference. While it's not fail-safe, game bags with the antimicrobial technology incorporated into the fabric can make a difference between salvaging all the meat from a kill and needing to throw meat out. So it's pretty cool what's in the bag. Getting your kill into a game bag ASAP after recovery can make a real difference. And it's never more apparent on public land out of state hunt. You're fortunate enough to fill a tag. Quality game bags are a critical part of protecting the meat from the kill while you're still in the field. The first mule deer hunt in New Mexico is a prime example. That's what the writer had said. Plan ahead. If you're looking to take your kid out in the youth hunt, planning for some herd control with the antler of the season, make sure you're ready to handle successful hunt. Coolers and bags of ice, having those prepared so you can get them into a refrigerated type scenario if you don't have a refrigerator or something on hand. It can make a difference. It really is an important piece to making sure that you do keep track what the temperature is going to do and really not let that meat get over the top. So
for those that hang, I mean, a lot of people like to hang their deer before they process them.
Mm-hmm.
From what I understand, you can hang them for up to 9 days if you've got temperature control.
Yep.
But most of them, you see that in a locker plant where they have quality temperature.
If it's under 40, you can do the same. That's one of the things that I find that we've done that in the past for many, many years, and it hasn't been a real issue. But
when it gets above 40 degrees, which in our area, it's at least it's going to be for the next
during the day,
next week or two anyway. I don't think you want them hanging in your garage.
No, you want to process it or get it to a processor pretty much as quickly as you can.
But aging it for 5-6 days is preferred for the quality of the meat.
It is. I think the difficult part about it, though, is don't take a chance at it.
Well, it's all based on the temperature, yep.
I think that's one of the challenges that comes into play. But, just be careful with your meat. Understand what's going on with it. And do not gamble with the meat. If you think it's going to be bad, if it looks bad or smells bad, make it go away, I think is the best way to put it.
Yep.
I think that's really the key piece to it. Generally, not all of it will go away, but that's kind of cool. When you make sure the bags are there, they work. Story coming out of Michigan. I have fished Saginaw Bay quite a bit, and I'm intrigued by what this is. A new spawning reef will benefit Michigan's Saginaw Bay fish. if you build it, such as in Field of Dreams, they will spawn. The walleye that are going to be in the Saginaw Bay area have responded well to an area called the Corian Reef that constructed that about 5 years ago. and it's about 7 miles off the eastern shoreline in Saginaw Bay. I have fished that, and they've known to have attracted spawning walleye and lake whitefish. Another reef will be constructed in the northeast of the contained spoils facility known as Shelter or Channel Island at the mouth of the Saginaw River at Bay City, according to a virtual public engagement meeting coordinated on Zoom by the Michigan Sea Grant late October. That near-island reef, said officials of several agencies during the meeting, aims to boost both fish habitat and coastal resilience. Jeff Jolly, actually, no, Jeff, he fished on the tour, supervisor for the DNR in the Southern Lake Huron Unit, which includes Saginaw Bay, called the Bay's bounce back from sedimentation, wetland loss, and pollution and development of an era of recovery and remarkable recovery. So pretty cool stuff. He said the constructed reefs are among the more and varied habitat types that suit a variety of fish, walleyes, and whitefish, and they are among the species that spawn on the rock reefs. Saginaw Bay had such habitat until sedimentation filled in gaps and crevices, ultimately covering the reefs, similar to what we have that sometimes happens here. If you see wing dams on the river, the first three are generally great, and then the rest are silted in until they almost always will all fill in eventually. This particular site of the reef project is designed to complement the Corian Reef and was selected after review of historical data. Pretty neat deal. Project goals in line with the Corian Reef Restoration Project include increased fish spawning, nursery habitat, and continued support of the resilient fishery. Saginaw Bay has really taken off as far as the fishery goes. And whether it's out on the Charity Islands or whatever, it's been pretty darn amazing. So, way to go. Appreciate that. Well, guess what? We're almost out of time. Don, we're back with Vexus.
It's going to be good.
On board. We're excited about that. Thanks to Vexus Boats. If you haven't had a chance, check them out on the Vexus Boats. We'll just put that in there for fun. VexusBoats.com. And
we'll have a connection.
We're going to have
website.
A link on the website, yeah. So you can check it out here. We're also going to have a number of interviews and some cool stuff coming up on the website. So stay tuned for that. Ava, we're going to be running bling. Vexus bling.
I dig it. I'm ready.
You ready?
Bring it on.
I love it. Well, thank you guys for hanging out with us. We certainly appreciate it. Hope you all have a safe deer opener in the state of Minnesota.
Good
and
luck
anywhere
out there.
You're going hunt. What?
Good luck out there.
Yeah, good luck out there, everybody. Stay dry and get them. Talk to you soon. Bye.